The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS, celebrating 30 years as the standard in the rare coin grading industry. Visit PCGS.com to learn more. The Coin Week podcast won the 2016 NLG Award for Best Audio Program. If you'd like to help the podcast grow and help us continue to bring you in-depth and thoughtful interviews and news coverage, please leave us a 5-star review on the iTunes Store. You can also download all 50 episodes for free. CoinWeek is the only numismatic website that brings you quality news reporting, feature articles, podcasts, and videos to help you take your hobby to the next level. This week on the CoinWeek podcast, we talk Morgan Dollars with a luminary in the field, Leroy Van Allen. Leroy recently wrote an exclusive article for CoinWeek.com that broke down his thoughts on the recently discovered 1964 Morgan Dollar based on footage that CoinWeek shot of the hubs at the Philadelphia Mint. You can access our video and Leroy's article about the hubs by going to CoinWeek.com. In this podcast, we talk about the hubs, what has surprised him most about silver dollars, and what it was like being on ground zero when the silver dollar phenomenon really took off. There's no one like Leroy Van Allen, and you get to hear what he had to say to us next on the Coin Week podcast. Oh, hi there, Leroy. This is Charles from Coin Week.
Hi, this is Leroy Van Allen. Good to meet you finally. You got a really great last name.
Well, you spent a lot of your numismatic life studying the Morgan Dollar. I bet you're a little bit surprised by seeing those 1964 Morgan Dollar hubs that have been in the news lately.
Yeah, I've heard them, of course, that have been in the literature, but I hadn't seen a picture of them yet, so I appreciate you sending it to me. It's a very, very good, excellent rendition of the old design.
So what do you make of the hubs? I mean, obviously, these weren't original hubs. Do you have any insights as to who might have engraved them?
Oh, they're definitely not the original, because there are some small differences on the obverse and reverse from the available coins. And, of course, all the hubs and dies were destroyed by the Mint in 1910. So there were no Morgan Dollar dies available after that time, so they had to make new hubs because they were about silver dollars. This is 1963-64, so they had to make new hubs, and then the hubs could make enough working dies so that they could produce the required 45 million Morgan or silver dollars that was authorized and the funds approved. Anyway, that's just a short synopsis.
So you spent quite a few years of your life researching Morgan dollars and different varieties that you've been able to discover through your close scrutiny. How much of that pioneering work do you think was made possible by the run-up in silver prices in the 1960s? And the fact that for speculative reasons and for collecting reasons, the treasury hoard was emptied of these coins.
Yeah, I became interested in the Morgan dollars when you could, back in the early 60s, 62, 63, they were released at Christmas time then. And I was a collector of just general, all different denominations. But then when the silver dollars became news that they were available, brand new. So I studied them and collected them. And then I eventually put out my first book in 1965. And meanwhile, of course, George Morgan, he was collecting silver dollars, also the Morgan dollars, researching them. And we got together in 71, published our first joint book, and then 76, the revision and update, which is published by First Coin Investors, And then, of course, another book in 1992 and the reprint in 98. So that's basically our history. So I've been involved in Morgan and Peace Dollars for well over 50 years.
Did you ever expect that the popularity of collecting Morgan and Peace Dollars by variety would take off to the point that it has as you were working on your book?
Well, there have been others before, you know, 1965, my book, published articles in various magazines and newspapers about some of the things they had found. In fact, it goes way back to the turn of the century where they looked at, there were a couple of publications in the numismatists about different varieties that they had found on the 1878s, and the designs were different. So the history of looking at the varieties of Morgan dollars goes way back to the, I think it's 1898. But there were no real books on them. Co-author George Malice, he put out a pamphlet, 100 copies, back in 1963. Neil Schaefer put out an article about the various designs, and I used that as a basis for my book in 1965, which I sold, of course, 5,000 copies. And so that started really some serious collecting and lots of collectors. But it's had its ups and downs. After our 76 book, there was a resurgence in collecting of dime varieties of silver dollars. And then it sort of died down a little bit, but it didn't completely die out. It was just not as much enthusiasm and numbers reported until Jeff Oxman and Michael Fay put out the top 100. I think that was in 1998. And that sort of helped focus what the collectors could put together. Instead of so many minor varieties, they just focused on the main ones like overdates and big gouges and breaks and things. But then there were other books put out and pamphlets since then, and so there's probably well over 24 pamphlets and documents and books on the Morgan dollar dye varieties.
Do you think anyone's ever come close to putting together a collection of every VAM that has been discovered and published in your books?
Well, Martin Field was trying to do that back in the 80s, but then he sold his collection and he passed away. He had probably 60-70% of all the dye varieties at that point in time, but of course since then there's been many more. And there's some collectors currently that maybe have 60-70%, but every year I put out a supplement which includes new discovered and reported and revised varieties. So this thing, it just keeps chugging along.
For a series that is seemingly full of surprises and the discovery of a 1964 Morgan dollar effort on the part of the Mint, certainly a surprise. What, in your opinion, was the most surprising thing about the Morgan dollar series?
Well, back in the 60s, the overdates, that was the big news then, for the 1880 overdates, and then this 87 over 6 overdates, and then there was also, they found back in the 60s, the 1900 over CCs. So that was the big news back then. But then there's been other ones, like a large over small date, 1998 O's. Those were reported, but we didn't have very good pictures, so we didn't know too much about it until last year, and an article about that was published in the Aeroscope. There's so many, you know, things been found, like acid treated 1878 by the San Francisco Mint. Here's a case where the San Francisco branch mint was modifying their dyes. That's, I don't know how they got away with it, because the Philadelphia Mint is one that makes the dyes. So they were altering, they added, well, they even engraved things on the tail feathers, and they engraved things on the wreaths of the reverse and on the obverse. So the San Francisco Mint took it upon themselves to sort of touch up these dyes in 1878. And also through 1882, that was a big surprise. There's so many different things that keep popping up on the Morgan dial. That's why I'm still doing this after 50 years. Collectors, I'm just mainly a cataloger now, because I don't have much of a collection anymore, and I don't examine the coins. I don't go to coin shows to examine them. So it's the collectors nowadays that they're searching through all these coins, and they sent coins to me pointing out things new, and I just take pictures, describe them, and I catalog it and put out a yearly supplement. So my job right now is mainly a cataloger. Back in the 60s and 70s, I reported a number of new varieties. Some were pretty significant, like over dates and over mint marks. But I'm mainly a cataloger, which keeps me busy and writing articles. And it's amazing what these collectors are still finding even today.
How would you say that the sophisticated collector today, the type of collector that would be interested in Morgan dollars by variety, how do you think this collector compares to the collectors of the 1960s and 70s?
Much more knowledgeable by far. You know, back then, there weren't too many people that had studied the minting process or how error coins or varieties were made. But they would report things like change of position of the mint mark and dates and, you know, dye doubling. But today's collector, they can really examine closely these dye varieties, and they send them to me with notations of what to look for and what they think are new. So they're very much more knowledgeable and experienced nowadays than they were back 40, 50 years ago. I'm just talking about Morgan dollars. Of course, other series like the large sense, and that they've had knowledgeable collectors for many years, and people really weren't too interested in the Morgan dollar or Peace dollar until the 60s, when it became more widely available. You know, nice new coins, and they could study them, and the hobby grew around the silver dollars.
So you said earlier in our conversation that for a time that people could walk up to their bank and get Morgan dollars at face value. Collectors that came around the hobby long after that probably can't relate to your story. It boggles the mind. But going back to the early 1960s, about how many Morgan dollars or dollar coins do you think your typical bank would have in the cash drawer, and what condition would they normally be in?
Well, both George Malice lived in Massachusetts, but he was an architect, and he had some jobs down Washington, D.C. area. So he would go to the Treasury Department there, and he would get a bag of 1,000 and lug it home. This is in the early 60s, 61, 62, 63, and then study them. Meanwhile, I lived in Baltimore, Maryland. I would go to the Reserve Bank in Baltimore, and then I also went down to the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., since I worked out of Washington, D.C., and you'll get a bag of 1,000 and take it home and look through it. I was always disappointed when it was just one date, you know, like 98 O's or 04 O's. I like the mixed date bags, which sometimes they're, you know, quite circulated. Other times they were a mixture of circulated and uncirculated. And then I went to local banks in Baltimore and also in D.C. And there you could get bags from them for a while. Then they started rationing. You could only get, a couple rolls or something like that. And then finally it was just a roll, and finally it was just a, you know, single coin, as they ran out of them. So it was quite an experience. And you get all these coins just for a dollar, big coins that were minted way back in the 1870s and 80s. Whereas all the minor coins, you couldn't go to the bank and get coins that old. So to me, that was the thrill of it.
And you could probably get some pretty well-worn seated dollars once in a while in circulation.
Yeah, once in a while, in the bags, circulated mainly, they would show up this, you know, the seated Liberty dollars. So, you know, I got a number of those also. But they were pretty far and few between. They weren't like the Morgan dollars where you could get a lot of uncirculated ones. You could get all dates. I found all dates except the 1889 CC, just going through bags and stuff and getting them at a dollar each. And so did my co-author, George Malice. But it was really crazy when they were starting to run out, and the dealers would flock down to Washington, D.C. and stand in line and get these bags. You know, I did some of that also. But
and did collectors at the time when they were pulling these bags out, if you're looking for original bags, you must have seen coins that would qualify as premium proof-like or deep mirror proof-like. And this was before those characteristics were a mainstream characteristic that collectors look for. Do you look back at those days and wish you would have put some of those aside?
Yeah, but you got to realize back in the 60s, I wasn't making that much money even as an engineer. So I wasn't rich. I was just a working guy. So I couldn't salt away, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars or hundreds of bags. So I would go through, pick out a few, you know, nice coins or other variety. I was mainly interested in the different varieties, but I did get some nice coins. Whereas there were dealers, they could salt away hundreds of bags, and some of the, you know, as you know, the hoards, some people put away hundreds of bags and have the funds to do that.
Are you at all surprised by the prices that these coins are bringing now, especially high-end toners?
Yeah, well, yeah, I had put some of my coins in auction a number of years ago, and I was just amazed at some of the prices that they bought, the varieties. But, well, that's the way inflation goes, and then, of course, it's the interest, the collector interest, and that creates bidding against one another, and that drives the prices up. And then you have to have, of course, the publications and so that the collectors know about the varieties and the significance and the rarity. It all ties together. You have to have a good collector base that forms the interest and can drive the prices up. That's on top of inflation, which is like death and taxes. It's also inflation just keeps going up and up. So the dollar, you know, the silver content value of the dollar, it just went higher and higher. And that, of course, was the base price for each coin. And the varieties are on top of that, so they're just a combination.
And of course, in the 1960s, pulling out a $1,000 bag and taking it home to look through the coins was nothing to blanch at. $1,000 back then was far more money than what people think of when they think of $1,000 today. Back then, it was really a significant amount of money.
Oh, yeah. When I graduated as an engineer in 57, my salary was a little over $5,000 a year. And, of course, then it kept going up and up, and I don't know what I was making. I forgot what I was making in 62 or 65. $1,000 for the average worker was a big, significant amount. 61, 62, I was making about $10,000 to $12,000 a year.
So then pulling out a bag like that was like withdrawing 1 month's salary, pre-tax. So back in the day when you're pulling these Morgan dollars, these uncirculated Morgan dollars out of original mint bags, did you see a lot of coins with vibrant rainbow toning, the kind of toning that you see in the market nowadays? Or did this kind of color develop on the coins after they were taken out of the bags?
No, toned coins had a market and a collector interest from the get-go. Because, big silver dollar coin, one and a half inches diameter, with these rainbow tones or multi-toned total side, they're beautiful. I would collect them, and they added value to the coin, not as much as some of the overdates and other things, but yeah, I was interested in toned coins way back then too, because they were just something that added to the beauty of the silver dollar.
So describe what it was like to get these 1,000 coin silver dollar bags from the Treasury in Washington, D.C. What was the setup like there? Did they make you go into the vault and carry your own bags, or did they get them for you? What was the setup there like, and how heavy were these things?
60 pounds, plus or minus. Anyway, you go to the Treasury Department, they had a window where you could order a bag or multiple bags in the early 60s. And I think you had to have cash in hand. And you give them the money, and they would go back to the vault and bring out a bag. You had no choice in what they brought out. They would just go to their local vault there in the Treasury and haul out whatever they happened to grab. The clerk would get for you and bring it out, usually on a dolly, and then you'd have to pick it up by hand and carry it by hand 60 pounds to your car or truck or whatever you had for a vehicle. So it was, you couldn't, if you ordered 10 bags, which you could at sometimes, that's just 600 pounds, so you had to have a pretty good-sized dolly to load all that up and cart it out. I never bought that many at a time. I may have bought two or three at a time once in a while. Most of the time, it's just one bag.
And while you're going back and forth to the Treasury to get bags, did you see other collectors or dealers doing the same thing?
Yeah, there were dealers that had the cash, of course. And they would buy multiple bags at a time. And up in Montana, they were the ones that used the silver dollars most up there as in general circulation. But there were some dealers up there, they would buy hundreds of bags and go through them and, pick out the good dates and good quality coins. And there are other deals that are all over the country that would, have access to buying these bags, and they would go through and, for the stock, buy and sell. And then there were the hoarders, which would just, they wanted hard money, so they would buy these silver dollars and store them away.
Do you suspect that there remain out there some hoards that haven't come to light?
There may be some small ones, but I think the big ones have been found, or else, I mean, the heirs and whatnot, they've cashed those in to get the money. I doubt if there's any real big hoards left now, but the hoards were treated in various books, like Wayne Miller's book and John Highfield's book and my book, and so the silver dollar hoards were interesting and big news, as I explained in the book, our book. And then, of course, there was the GSA. They put aside well over $3 million Carson City dollars as their stock depleted, and then they had the auctions. And I was involved in that with the GSA down in Washington, D.C., since I was an engineer down in Washington, D.C., and I became a consultant on the GSA sale of the silver dollars of Carson City.
You know, I've speculated, or at least opined in some of my writing, that the U.S. government's GSA sale was essentially the beginning of an era where a whole generation of collectors just entering the hobby would form a lifelong relationship with the government and the U.S. Mint as a source of coins beyond what had come before. They used the GSA cases to market the very expensive Eisenhower dollar proof coins. Many collections formed from the 1970s and beyond, their first contact with coins might have been the nationally run ads for the GSA coins, and then that turned into purchasing other products from the Mint, such as bicentennial coins and medals, and later commemorative coins and annual Mint and proof sets. I've run into a number of collections, helping people appraise collections belonging to their mothers or fathers that pass away. And I see a similar strain of collecting habits from people who maybe didn't have a lot of means to buy what we consider classic rarities, but they could afford to spend $100 or so every year buying coins from the Mint. And I suspect a lot of this started with the first purchase of a GSA Carson City Morgan dollar. My own grandmother, Ruth, is an example of that.
Yeah, there was gigantic publicity. You know, they made these little cards and displays for all the main banks. So people going in there would realize that they could get these old, real old silver dollars, 1800s, from this auction. And yes, you're right. It's the GSA sales did produce a lot of national publicity and all local publicity with their displays. They even had a display that went around the country. And so it did create a lot of interest in the silver dollars and just, like you say, collectors in general.
Well, Mr. Van Allen, thank you so much for spending time talking to me about Morgan dollars, your life's passion, and those 1964 Morgan dollar hubs.
Okay. Nice talking to you. And, it's been a thrill ride for these 50 years, that's for sure.
If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. And remember, you can download all 50 of CoinWeek's award-winning podcasts for free from the iTunes Store. For CoinWeek, I'm Editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting.